This episode includes graphic testimony that some may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
On December the 20th of 2013, Alex's life was cut short. This defendant, Mark Taylor, is responsible for Alex's death.
We believe that there are other explanations. This culture is a culture you'll learn that sucks you in, but it's a culture that will kill you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm advised you've reached a verdict. Is that correct?
3 weeks after Mark Taylor was arrested near the U.S. border with Mexico, he was extradited back to Kentucky and booked into the Fayette County Detention Center. As tough as he'd made the investigation on police up until that point, he didn't fight the extradition. His legal battles came fast, though. At the time in Kentucky, kidnapping was an aggravated charge when the outcome was murder, which made Mark Taylor eligible for the death penalty, and prosecutors were gunning for it all through 2014 and 2015, and it was still on the table in 2016 as Taylor geared up for his trial to take place that summer. But in February, 4 months before Taylor went before a jury, the Kentucky Supreme Court changed the law. Alex's mom, Judy Johnson, felt blindsided.
Is that something that you wanted if that had been on the table?
Absolutely. I believe in the death penalty. That's the only thing that would deter people from committing crimes, and even then, knowing that that's a possibility, even then, that doesn't work.
This time, it was Mark Taylor that caught a break. The most he could get for a conviction was life without parole. Prosecutors, meanwhile, made a deal with Timothy Ballard. Tiny was charged with kidnapping and tampering with physical evidence in connection to Alex's death. And because he was on parole at the time of the crime, a persistent felony offender would be looking at the rest of his life in prison if a jury found him guilty. Prosecutors recommended 25 years for Tiny. But he would have to testify against Mark Taylor at his murder trial. Tiny took the deal. Commonwealth's attorney Luanna Redcorn explained why it was offered during radio host Jack Patty's News Talk 590 show in July of 2016.
And clearly, Mr. Ballard had demonstrated at least some, taken some responsibility. He talked to the police every time that they came to him. He took the police down to the river and showed them where he had rolled the barrel into the river. So he helped. And that was a big thing for this family, or for any family, to be able to find their loved one when they're missing like this. So there was not a lot of decision to be made about whether to deal with Mr. Ballard or not. Mr. Taylor, on this night, before this happened, was riding around in the back seat of his own car alone while Mr. Ballard was driving him. I mean, the dynamic between the two was quite apparent. Would you agree with that, Rob?
Absolutely. We've even got video where Mr. Ballard would open the back door for Mr. Taylor and then close it, acting as a chauffeur.
Really? So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, the notion that Mr. Ballard was calling the shots and was the ringleader of this whole thing was ridiculous.
June 6th, 2016, 2.5 years after Alex disappeared, a pool of potential jurors filled a Fayette County Circuit courtroom.
How about selecting a jury? Was that difficult?
Well, in a case like this, obviously, pretrial publicity is kind of a big deal, and you want to find people that haven't heard anything about the case or haven't made up their mind. And actually, I was kind of surprised how many people didn't know. It had been several years. It wasn't as difficult as I thought it would be.
Okay.
This was it. Justice for Alex. And it was a surprise to investigators just how many people wanted to be a part of it.
This one really did get a lot of attention, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I would go over periodically. The courtroom was full. Yeah. I mean, it's of lawyers and family members and just spectators.
The afternoon of June 6th, Commonwealth's assistant Andrea Mattingly walked to a podium facing the 12 jurors and began her opening statement.
The only son of Lee and Judy, the big brother to Casey, and Lisa's boyfriend. 32 years old, just shy of his 33rd birthday. A graduate of Transylvania University. A chef at the Boone Center on UK's campus. Passionate about cooking and camping. That was Alex Johnson. On December the 20th of 2013, Alex's life was cut short. He was beaten in the back of a Mercedes-Benz in a spare parts parking lot. His body was put in a barrel and the barrel thrown in the Kentucky River. The Commonwealth will prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant, Mark Taylor, is responsible for Alex's death. The police investigation revealed that in the days leading up to the murder, there was a plan. There was no activity on Alex's phone. It all ended on December the 20th at 8:42 when he hung up with Lisa.
Next up, Taylor's attorney, Sandra Downs.
Prosecution, I agree on some things. Obviously, we disagree on other things. We agree on the fact that this was a brutal crime, and that as a result of that, a man ends up dead. A man who didn't deserve to die, but we also believe that there are other explanations. One of the things that you're going to find is the only witness to the actual crime that you will hear from is a man we call Tiny. And obviously the reason they call him Tiny is that he's huge. You will learn that Tiny gave 5 statements, and the Commonwealth has just told you about 4 of them. The 5th one, though, was after he agreed to plead guilty to a very good deal on his part. And I'm sure that he'll tell you about that deal. We agree that my client, Robert Martin Taylor, was also at the scene when this happened. We agree that all these people were friends, except for Tiny. The Commonwealth would have you believe Mark Taylor killed a man he loved. They would have you believe that Mark Taylor is a murderer. Mark Taylor's a drug dealer. There's no doubt about that. We don't try to hide that. Nor do we try to hide that Mark did some really stupid things after this happened. You will hear that that night, Mark was involved in doing a lot of drugs. As a result, he made some bad mistakes. He did not kill his friend. Listen to Tiny. Watch Tiny. Hear what Tiny says. Because if you believe that Mark Taylor is a murderer, you have to believe Tiny.
First up on day 2, prosecutors called Alex's girlfriend, Lisa Horobin, to the stand. She testified about what she knew of Alex's marijuana business, their plans for the future, and their last phone call December 20th.
We talked for, like I said, an hour and a half. He was baking brownies and like cookies for people for Christmas because he loved to cook. And then that's when he got a knock on the door while I was on the phone with him.
What do you hear next?
I can hear him walk to the door. And open the door.
All right.
And then I hear Mark Taylor say, "Hey, buddy, come downstairs. I have a surprise for you."
Okay. Now, you knew Mark Taylor?
Yes.
You knew his voice?
Yes.
And are you sure the voice you heard was Mark Taylor?
Yes.
Okay. And when Mark Taylor says, "Hey, buddy, come downstairs. I have a surprise for you," what did Alex say?
Alex told me that Mark was at his house.
Okay.
And that he was going to get going. And I had known from our conversations earlier in the week, and during that time that we had spoke that evening, that he had plans with Mark to go out that night to some place called Trust.
Did you try to get hold of Mark Taylor?
Yes. I don't know if it was that Sunday or a couple of days later, but I knew that he was at his house that evening, so I figured maybe he can tell me what happened. I didn't have Facebook, so I actually used my little brother's Facebook and found him on there and wrote him a message saying, "I know you were with Alex. I haven't heard from him. I'm starting to get worried. Here's my phone number. Can you call me back? Let me know."
And did you ever hear back from Mark Taylor?
I did not.
The jury then heard the 911 calls and from Sarah Connor, the woman who'd reached out to the Find Alex Johnson Facebook page. Casey Johnson also briefly testified, followed by Detective Rob Wilson.
You've had an opportunity to see both the defendants, in this case, the one that's on trial, as well as the one that is not today, Mark Taylor and Tiffany Ballard.
Yes, ma'am.
Could you describe each of them physically?
Mr. Taylor, I would describe as of average size, approximately 6 foot, probably 170, 180 pounds, just very average. Mr. Ballard is quite enormous. I believe his height was listed at 6'8". And when at the time of his arrest, I believe he weighed over 400 pounds.
So there was a palpable or observable difference?
A very distinct difference in their size, yes.
This description was a critical point of the trial, and you'll understand why when we get there. Day three was packed full of witnesses called by the prosecution in an effort to show that Alex's murder was premeditated, calculated, every detail planned by Mark Taylor both before and after December 20th, beginning with a man named John Johns.
And while you were in Florida, did you receive a telephone call from Timothy Ballard?
I did. He called me on the 19th of December. We were already there and wanted to know if he could borrow the truck to deliver furniture for his sister. And I knew he lived with his sister because I would pick him up from there and take him to work and then bring him back to that location.
Ballard's girlfriend, Amy Roberts, worked for John Johns, and Tim had borrowed his truck for odd jobs before. Johns explained there was no reason to suspect the call on the 19th was anything out of the ordinary. Next up, prosecutors called Brandon Roberts, a man Mark Taylor occasionally paid cash to clean his apartment. But this request was different.
And did Mr. Taylor give you any instructions on what to clean within the garage?
He just said that he had an inspection coming and he just needed to make sure that the garage was up to par and that just to make sure that the floors were done and stuff like that and just the walls and stuff like that.
And so did he give you a specific time to go clean the garage?
He just told me to kind of go around 3 in the morning, try to be done by 4 to make sure it was, make sure everything was done up to par to where when they came in to look at it.
And was that an unusual time for him to request for you to go clean the garage?
To me, I mean, it may have been unusual, but I mean, it wasn't nothing.
And where did you clean when you went in that day?
The two bays and the pretty much mostly everywhere. I swept and mopped everywhere else, but then I cleaned and scrubbed the floors on the bay to where they was clean and stuff.
Okay.
I cleaned bay 2 and bay 3.
Okay. And so did Mr. Taylor specifically ask you to clean those two bay door or bay floors?
Yeah, just to make sure that those was just pretty much cleaned to where, like I said, he's had an inspection come as far as I know, and then that was it.
And did he also ask you to make sure that you wiped down all the locks and the levers?
Yeah, walls, door jams, stuff like that.
And do you remember telling the police that Mr. Taylor asked you to make sure that you clean the levers and the locks and the handles in the garage?
Yeah, doors, jams, everything like that, yes.
And when you talk about the locks and the levers, where were those locks and levers?
On the side of the door.
On the side of the door? Okay. And do you remember telling the police that you called Mark and said, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah, I left that on the machine, on the answer machine.
And do you remember telling the police that Mr. Taylor told you, man, it wasn't supposed to go down like this, I'm sorry?
No, that wasn't the time that that happened. What that was about was a totally different thing.
Here's Taylor's attorney.
So, man, it wasn't supposed to go like this. What context was that statement being made by?
I had met another guy to pick up some marijuana from, and I stated that short on what it was supposed to be. And he was like, man, my fault, it wasn't supposed to went that way. That's all that was about, man.
Please tell the jury your name.
Luis Rodriguez.
And Mr. Rodriguez, you understand English?
Well, yeah, I understand.
How long have you been speaking English?
Long time.
Long time.
Not very well, but I try.
Not very well? Okay.
I try.
This witness for the prosecution owned a car repair shop across the street from Mark's Lexington apartment. He called Mark both a customer and a friend and told the jury Mark had multiple cars and was known to buy them cheap and flip them.
Did you ever know the defendant to have a Mercedes?
Yes, ma'am.
And what color was the Mercedes?
Light brown, something like that.
Did it have four doors?
Yes, ma'am.
And did it have a sunroof?
Yep.
At some point, did you buy the Mercedes from the defendant?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about that.
Well, I just buy it. Told me they just called me and said that he was want to junk the car.
And what does it mean to junk a car?
When a car does not work, it
Would you take it to the scrapyard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And do you remember about what date that you got the Mercedes?
Really, I'm not as specific the day, but I remember it was, a couple days before New Year's.
Tell me about the Mercedes when you got it from Mr. Taylor. What was the condition?
I think the transmission that wasn't work. The mirrors was broke, and they had paint all over the car. Like somebody did it, purpose. I don't know.
Were the seats still in the car?
No.
No. Okay. Did the car smell like anything?
Yeah, it smelled like bleach.
Smelled like what?
Bleach.
Smelled like bleach. And did you ask Mr. Taylor about the condition of the car?
No, I was asking when he told me to buy it, to junk it, I said, can I fix it? Say, no, because I don't have the title. So, and I asked him what happened, and he just told me, you don't want to know. So I don't ask no more questions then.
He said you don't want to know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you didn't ask any more questions?
No.
Now, what did you do with the Mercedes at that point?
Junk it.
June 9th, day four of the trial, was a big one for prosecutors. It was the day the jury heard from their star witness, Taylor's co-defendant, Timothy Ballard. You've already heard some of it, how after prison, Tiny got a job at Riptides and met Mark Taylor, then became Mark's personal chauffeur when the restaurant went under. He told the jury that on the morning of December 20th, Mark asked Tiny to use the truck that he'd borrow from John Johns to pick up a 55-gallon barrel that Taylor claimed was going to be used for trash. He was told to pick it up and take it back to Mark's shop.
And what happened after you got to the shop?
Taylor wasn't acting like Taylor. Taylor's usually calm, cool, and collected, you know, fun going and stuff. He was real antsy.
Did you talk about that?
No, I didn't even think about it. I just noticed it.
Okay. Was it dark outside at the time?
No, it was afternoon.
All right. What happens the rest of the afternoon?
Just sat in the shop. Some people came by, purchased a little bit of marijuana, and that was it.
The afternoon was rather nondescript, according to Ballard, until that night when they got into the champagne-colored Mercedes and took off toward Alex's.
And when you got to Mr. Johnson Street, where did you park?
Right in front of his house.
Did you get out of the car and go in or stay in the car?
No, I did not. I stayed in the car.
At this point, Mr. Ballard, what did you know about what was going to happen that evening?
Mr. Taylor talked about killing Mr. Johnson.
And when did you all have that conversation?
On the way over there.
On the way over there?
Yes, ma'am.
Did he tell you how this was going to happen?
He said he was going to choke him and then beat him.
Did he ask you to participate?
He asked me to drive.
How long was Mr. Taylor out of the car before he came back?
A couple minutes.
And when he came back, where did each of them go? The defendant, Taylor, and Alex.
I watched Mr. Johnson and Mr. Taylor come out of the apartment. They were laughing, giggling, like they usually do. And Mr. Taylor got in the back seat. Mr. Johnson got in the front seat.
Describe, as best you can, moment by moment, what happened after the two of them got into the car.
As we proceeded to drive, Mr. Taylor grabbed him in a chokehold from behind, started choking him. There was a bunch of screaming and hollering. Mr. Taylor pulled him to the back seat, and they proceeded to fight each other.
And who was driving?
I was. They were fighting. I looked back there one time. Taylor was hitting down. Mr. Johnson was hitting up. So they were actually in a scuffle in the back seat.
Okay. Where were Mr. Johnson's legs?
Mr. Johnson's legs, he was laying on his back in the seat.
Was anything being said?
Just
or
a lot
were
of,
there any noises?
A lot of cussing, a lot of ramping, raving, and cussing. Mr. Taylor stated that this needs to be done. It needs to be done. You don't need it, you know. And then from there, I stopped the car.
Why did you stop the car?
I don't know who said it, but I heard stop the car.
And what happened when you stopped the car?
I seen Mr. Taylor backing out of the rear passenger door.
Go ahead.
And Mr. Johnson was kicking at him. I ran, got out of the front seat and ran around to the rear seat to see what they were actually doing. I mean, I had no agenda at the time. I just ran around there. Mr. Taylor grabbed Mr. Johnson by his feet and jerked him out of the car.
Was Mr. Johnson still alive at that point?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Mr. Taylor from there ran around and got in the front seat of the car.
Okay.
I reached down to help Mr. Johnson up, and he kicked me. And when he did, I hit him.
And what did you hit him with?
I hit him with the top of my fist, but I had a black object in my hand at the time.
Okay, what was that object?
It was a broken nightstick. Then he cussed me out, and I told him to get in the car, and he got in the car and sat up behind Mr. Taylor.
So he was still conscious at this point?
Yes, he was.
Was anyone bleeding at this point?
He was bleeding in the face.
Where did you go in the car then?
I tried to get my big frame inside the back door.
Okay. But
the front seat was pulled all the way back, so a big man like myself, uh-huh, with long legs and big feet, Mr. Taylor started driving away as I was trying to get in the vehicle.
Do you know if anyone saw you when you were stopped there, still on Hanover?
I seen a young man on a bicycle. That's okay. All I seen.
So who's driving now?
At the point, Mr. Taylor's driving.
And where do you, what is going on in the back seat?
Nothing. There's a lot of cussing, foul language going on, and I'm still trying to get in the back seat.
Okay. And who's driving?
Mr. Taylor.
And where do you all go?
To a dirt lot.
Now, had you been to that dirt lot before?
No, ma'am.
Do you know what kind of business that was in the dirt lot?
No, ma'am.
What was Mr. Johnson doing at this point in the back seat?
He was sitting in the back seat, cussing at me, ramping and raving, but he was still alive.
Was he fighting with you?
He wasn't doing anything.
Was he trying to get out of the car?
No.
Prosecutors play the surveillance video uncovered by detectives from the spare parts store, and they ask Ballard to narrate it.
Who is that getting out of the driver's seat?
Mr. Taylor.
And what did he do after he got out of the driver's seat?
He opened up the back door and started beating on Mr. Johnson.
Did he have any instrument with him at that point?
A little silver object.
What did it look like?
It looked like a small knife sharpener, but it wasn't. It didn't have no ridge, and it was very smooth. It had a hole at the end. It looked like a fishing lure.
Did it have a handle? Or?
Yes. It had a handle like a bicycle grip, but like I said, it was all smooth and real light.
Okay. And what was the tip of it like?
Just rounded.
Rounded on the tip. And does he have that at this point?
Yes.
What was he doing now?
He was hitting him in the head with it.
Okay. And what were you doing?
I was sitting there watching him.
Now what are you all doing?
I'm opening the back door, and Mr. Taylor had his arm, and I helped him pull Mr. Johnson into the back seat.
Okay, at this point, where are the two of you?
We're both in the front seats.
Okay, who's driving?
I am.
Where's Mr. Taylor?
Mr. Taylor's in the passenger seat.
And what's Alex Johnson's condition at this point?
At this point in time?
Yes.
He's still alive.
And how do you know that?
Because I heard him take his last breath when I drove away.
Do you believe he died in the car?
I believe so.
What was it that you heard that made you think that?
He gurgled, and that was it.
Ballard testified he drove Mark and Alex's lifeless body back to Mark's shop. Mark got out, went inside with his bloody hands, and opened the third bay door of his garage.
Once we're inside, like I said, I vomited. Mr. Taylor vomited. From inside, he was real jumpy, you know, it was like he was happy. He had the barrel that we went and picked up.
Right.
Had a bunch of holes punched through it, and the top of it was peeled back. He opened up the back door. Mr. Taylor placed Mr. Johnson in the barrel. It's a big barrel, so he didn't have to shove him in or anything. He just went in.
Was he bloody?
Yes.
Was Mr. Taylor bloody?
There was blood on his clothes, yes.
About you?
I didn't have any blood on me.
You testified about things that the defendant Taylor was saying during the time of the beating. What were those things?
He was ranting things that didn't make sense. Okay, he was very upset, and that's a side I'd never seen of him. He was saying things like, "You should have gave it to me beforehand. I should have had it before." Just cussing, a lot of cussing and ramping and raving.
Did he explain to you later why he was upset with Mr. Johnson?
No, he did not.
And then what happened?
And then he told me to take the body to Riptides and put the body with the barrel inside the river.
Okay. And did you do that?
Yes, ma'am. I drove the truck down the hill, backed it down, opened up the tailgate, and it rolled out of the back of the tailgate and rolled into the river.
And then what did you do?
I got in the truck and I left.
And where did you go?
Back to the shop.
Tiny testified then, in another one of Mark's cars, they went back to Alex's, where Mark took $40,000 cash and 26 pounds of marijuana. For his help getting rid of Alex, Tiny says he was paid $18,000. No weed, because he says he wasn't into that. From there, the two cleaned up, changed clothes, and according to timestamps on security cameras at Trust, walked into the club after 11 o'clock, not even 3 hours after arriving at Alex's apartment.
Did you drink there at the Trust?
That's the funny thing. I'm not a drinker, but yes, I did. I drank two of Grey Goose and soda.
Okay, why did you do that?
To relax. I was very, after what I just seen, I was upset, truly.
And what was the defendant's, Taylor's, demeanor like during the evening at Trust?
He's always bebopping around and dancing and, associating with people.
And was he doing it that night?
Yes.
Was he drinking that night?
Yes.
Did he appear to be having a good time?
Of course.
Were you dancing that night?
No.
Were you bebopping around that night?
No.
Where did you stay during the time you were at Trust?
Mostly right there at the seat you saw me sitting in.
And where did you take him after you left Trust?
He took me back to his apartment.
And what happens when you get back to his apartment?
We talk, and then he goes to bed, and I go to bed.
Did you sleep at his apartment that night?
Yes, I did.
Mark Taylor wasn't around much the next few days, Ballard told the jury, but by December 31st, he was back in town and primed a party by ringing in the new year with all of his buddies, Ballard included. There was a quiet hush over the Fayette County courtroom on day five as the two sets of attorneys concluded a bench conference with Judge Thomas Clark and returned to their respective sides, and then heard this from Sandra Downs.
Your Honor, at this time, we would call Robert Marcus.
Yes, sir. If you'd raise your right hand, please. Do you swear or affirm testimony about to give me the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
For the first several minutes, Ms. Downs talked to Mark about his childhood, what brought him to Kentucky, and how he met Alex. She then pressed her client for his account of what happened the night of December 20th, and what followed was wildly different than the one told by Timothy Ballard.
We went to Alex's house.
And what did you do while you were at Alex's house?
I knocked on the door. He was on the phone with, I believe, Lisa. I said, "What's up, man? I got a surprise." Alex didn't necessarily have the clothes that wanted him to wear. He showed me some clothes that were very bad. So I told him that I had something at the house for him to wear. We had discussed it previously in the week. Alex turned to Mr. Ballard, Tim, Tiny, and there was an offhanded comment made. It could have been something like, "What's up, bitch?" I don't remember. I believe at the time I was texting, but Tim started to go off on Alex. I don't know why, but he had a baton in his hand, and he started hitting Alex backhanded as he sat next to him. I'm almost positive we ran the stop sign. Tim got off 8-10 hits before I even noticed what was going on, and Alex was screaming, "Stop! What are you doing?" It was a blood.
What were you doing?
At that time, I realized what was going on and dove in between the two. I said, "Stop! Stop the car! Stop!" Tim didn't really say anything. He stopped the car, though. Got out from around the driver's seat of the car, went to the passenger seat. Alex was still buckled into his seatbelt, so he was slumped over, and he was slumped out of the car.
Did Mr. Johnson scream?
Yes, a lot.
What did you do?
Tim got out of the car and went around to the driver's side of the car and continued to hit Alex multiple times until he didn't scream anymore. I remember at one point he looked back and said something to the nature of, "I have witnesses now. I might as well kill you."
Mark says Ballard was referring to the male witness who later called 911.
After Tim made the statement that he saw witnesses, he got back in the car and took off. I believe the car door was still open. Alex was still hanging out of the car.
At any point, now this is your best friend. You're sitting there beside your best friend watching him get beat up. What did you do?
I didn't know what to do. I honked the horn. Finally, when the car stopped, I pulled him out to check his vitals to see if he was even responsive. He was breathing, but was not conscious. His face was mangled.
What did Mr. Ballard do?
He loomed over top of me. I was very intoxicated at the time. I didn't know what to do. I put Alex back in the back seat. I told Tim to take Alex and put him in the back seat. We needed to get him somewhere.
Did you, in fact, ever strike Mr. Johnson?
No.
You saw the film?
Yes.
Can you explain what you were doing behind the car when it was stopped?
Yes. I was trying to resuscitate Alex. I have training in CPR, laid him long ways on the ground, tried to give him chest compressions. He was not responsive. He had no pulse. He had no... Alex was dead. Alex was dead.
Where did you go next?
We went to the shop.
Why did you not then go and call the police?
I don't trust the police. I never have. At that point, the threats became a little more direct. Don't make a mistake here, Mark. Let's just get this taken care of. Don't make a mistake. I broke down. I had a solid 40 minutes to myself, and I broke down, and I cried. And because of, I was on Molly. I was rolling at the time, and I didn't know what else to do. Wanted to get around people as soon as possible. I didn't want to be next to this man.
But you left with him.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
To pacify him, to make him feel as if I was in this with him, to don't worry about things, we'll take care of it. I had just seen this man with a weapon. I saw Alex's face. I just saw what he did over nothing.
Alex Johnson was dead, beaten to death in the back of a Mercedes. And while his body was still warm, sinking in the barrel to the floor of a freezing Kentucky river, Mark Taylor and Timothy Ballard washed up, put on their Friday night best, and drove to a popular Lexington nightclub, where video, pulled by detectives, showed an excited, dancing Mark Taylor waiting to get into the club.
You know that the question is, Mr. Taylor, that all these jurors are going to have, and that even myself might have, is why did you not report it? Why didn't you get help?
My relationship with the police department here in Lexington is a complicated one. I don't trust police. I never have. They've never done anything for me. They didn't stop my mom or dad abuse. They didn't stop anything in my life. They've never done anything for me. Considering my drugs, considering my usage, considering my state of mind at the time, and the fact that I did have blood on my hands, I did not feel comfortable at all trying to report this or explain it to anybody at the time.
Mark's attorney wrapped her line of questioning after that, and it was Prosecutor Luanna Redcorn's turn on cross-examination.
You've sat through this entire trial, right?
Yes.
And all of the witnesses that testified, you've known before this trial what they were going to say, right?
Not necessarily.
Many of them gave recorded conversations to the police, didn't they?
Yes.
You've had an opportunity to listen to those.
Yes.
Almost everyone the police talked to, they made a written memorandum, didn't they?
Yes.
You've had an opportunity to read those, right?
Yes.
You've watched all the videos that surveillance that the police obtained.
Yes.
So you've known before you walked in here today exactly what the evidence was going to be against you. Is that right?
An accurate reflection? Yeah.
And you've had the opportunity to come up with a story to explain every single thing that happened, haven't you?
No.
Isn't that exactly what you've done here? Fed this jury a line?
No.
Told them a tale that absolutely is not true?
No.
For the next several minutes, Redcorn went day by day through the chilling text messages Mark sent Alex in the days after his murder. She never did get a straight answer for why Mark Taylor would continue to call and text a dead man. Then she attempted to pick apart Mark's explanation that he was terrified of Timothy Ballard after the events of December 20th.
So in advance of killing your friend, you ask your employee, Timothy Ballard, to borrow a truck that you could use that night, right? In fact, after you were done with this truck, you followed him back to return the truck, right?
I did.
I mean, you were telling us that you had just seen the most horrific thing happen that you had nothing to do with, and you get in the car and follow the guy back to the place where you borrowed the truck?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense, does it?
Why not?
If you were so afraid of him, you could have driven off in another direction, right?
Yes.
You could have gone back to the garage, kept him from coming in?
Yes, I could have.
And you didn't do any of that?
No.
Because that's not how my uncle went. And then you trashed your own Mercedes, right?
No.
Painted the outside of it, smashed the mirrors, removed the back seat?
No.
Well, then how did all that happen?
It's a high crime rate on the west end of Kentucky, west end of Lexington. A cherry Mercedes sitting out in that area can quickly be stripped of its tires, rims, back leather seats, anything.
And when your Mercedes was trashed like that, you called the police right away, right, to make a report?
I mean, no, it had problems anyways with the transmission and such.
You asked Luis to jump the car for you?
Yes.
Is Luis the person in your phone contacts that you call Hispanic mechanic?
Yes.
And you sold him this trash Mercedes for $100, right?
Yes.
And he wanted to fix it, didn't he?
He wants to fix everything, so...
Right. And you wouldn't let him, would you?
No, not this particular one.
Why not?
Because it was a junk car, and it didn't really have a future.
What does it matter to you if you sold it to him for $100 if he wanted to take the time and effort to fix it?
He could have very well taken it to his house and fixed it and told me that it was junked and been on with it.
Do you think that by asking this guy to junk it instead of fix it, that it keeps it from being discovered by the police?
No.
Wasn't Alex's blood in the back seat of that vehicle?
Yes. That was where Alex was when he died.
And in fact, you tried to clean out the back seat of the car with bleach, right?
Yes.
And when that wouldn't work, that's why you trashed the vehicle, right?
No.
Redcorn pulls up the surveillance video from the spare parts store again and dims the lights.
Can you see the silhouette of the man in that car?
Yes.
Do you see what he's doing?
Seems like he's throwing punches.
Raising and lowering his arm?
Yes.
You know how many times Alex was struck in the head?
How many?
Over 20. You see that arm going up and down and up and down again?
Yes.
On December 21st at 6:52 in the morning, this would have been after Alex was killed, you sent some text messages to Mr. Ballard. Do you remember that?
No.
This is a text message, December 21st. If you do the time right, it is exactly at 6:52 in the morning to Tiny Tim B. Is that Tim Ballard?
Yes.
Okay. And this is your text to him. What was that text message?
Love ya over at David's at the moment.
Love ya over at David's at the moment, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And Mr. Ballard replied?
Make sure I have the car by 10 a.m.
So you sent him another text?
Already there, baby.
Already there, baby. And then Mr. Ballard responded to you and said?
Okay, cool, enjoy yourself, love ya.
Okay, cool, enjoy yourself, love you.
Yes.
These are text messages between you and a guy you said you could never be friends with?
This is an attempt to pacify a man who has a very bad temper.
Like the Commonwealth set out to show as they began to cross Mr. Taylor, Mark had an explanation for everything. All the chilling moves he'd made in the days prior to Alex's death, mere coincidence, Taylor said. But the Commonwealth was confident they had proven that Mark Taylor had killed his friend, Alex Johnson, in cold blood. And the prince, prosecutors suggested, was about to get his power.
By your own words, Mr. Taylor, you are a major drug dealer, right?
Yes. Yes.
And if you killed Alex Johnson, you'd be even bigger drug dealer.
Mark Taylor's fate was now in the hands of the jury, who had heard 7 excruciating days of testimony. It took the men and women on the panel less than 4 hours to make their decision. On June 15, 2016, Judge Thomas Clark addressed the courtroom.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm advised you've reached a verdict. Is that correct?
All right, I'll read the verdict of the jury. As to count one, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of intentional murder under instruction number 3, signed by juror 3251 as foreperson. As to count two, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of kidnapping under instruction number 9, signed by juror 3251 as foreperson. As to count three, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of tampering with physical evidence under instruction number 11, signed by juror 3251 as foreperson.
During the sentencing phase that evening, Alex's family could only call one witness. They put Alex's mom, Judy Johnson, back on the stand. The defense put up four.
He's amazing. He's compassionate.
As he grew up, though, he was very calm, very gentle person.
I mean, Mark basically has been my big brother.
I'd say responsible, gentle, kind. I mean, it's very, very loving. He was very energetic and ready to please.
He's someone that I could personally tell everything to and just connect with, so.
Was he protective?
He cared about me an awful lot.
None of it helped. Judge Thomas Clark threw the book at Mark Taylor. 22 years for murder, another 22 for kidnapping, and 5 for tampering with evidence. The sentences should run one after another, he decided, for a total of 49 years. Next time on Taking Alex.
Well, I was absolutely sure that we wouldn't hear from him again, that he would just go away and hopefully be miserable in prison.
Fran, how do you say your last name?
Yes, it's like Taylor von der Heiden.
Fran Taylor von der Heiden. What was it that attracted you to him?